and welcome to the 6 North of Scotland Parkinson's Research Interest Group podcast with me, Julie Jones. A very warm welcome to those who are joining us today for the first time. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget that all the prior podcasts are available to download on Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts or Amazon Audible. So, like all our prior NOSPREG podcasts, the topics and researchers we have interviewed are guided by the Parkinson's community. So if you have any areas of research or a particular researcher you'd like us to hear from, please do visit the NOSPREG web pages and contact us with your suggestions. So today we've received a number of requests to have a pod which focuses on research terminology, as many people from the Parkinson's community have reported that the terminology used in research makes it difficult to follow and puts them off engaging in research. So today's session is very much a research 101, where I have a number of questions which people have sent in to ask our research expert. So I'm delighted to welcome Professor Gareth Jones to the pod today. Gareth is an epidemiologist based in the Institute of Applied Health Science at the University of Aberdeen. As an epidemiologist, Gareth is interested in what causes conditions, patterns of conditions and the outcomes. But perhaps put more simply, he's interested in who gets what and why. Gareth's main interest in research is on the management of arthritis and musculoskeletal conditions and chronic pain, but integral to his work is involving communities in research. Earlier this year, Gareth ran a public research event here in Aberdeen with the purpose of making research more accessible to members of the public, which included explaining some of the key research terms in a way that those who are new to research can understand it more easily. Hence, we've invited him to the pod today. Right then, Gareth, I think that's enough from me. Thank you very much for joining us on the pod today. So I have a whole list of questions, 2 pages of questions here. So I've tried to put them in a logical order. So we'll just start at the top. So I think the first thing we really want to have is really some of the terminology. So I wonder if you could just chat us through what is the difference between research engagement, research involvement and research participation?
Okay, well, those are 3 different ways that patients and the public can get involved in research. Engagement tends to be involvement in the dissemination of research. This is something that I'm very keen on, work very hard to do when we publish our research papers or our scientific presentations at conferences. We also try and make them accessible to the lay audience. And so research engagement would be that. So for example, on our website we have lay summaries of all our work. We do presentations to lay audiences and to the public and to charities. Involvement in research is when patients and the public actually get involved in what we're doing. So they may be on the committees that design the studies, they may be on the steering committees that oversee the studies, or it may be sort of focus groups and individual patient input into coming up with the research questions that we're then going to study. And the last one, participation, is actually those are the people that we are studying. So obviously, if you're studying clinical populations, you need patients to contribute data, to dedicate their time and their efforts to filling in the questionnaires, undergoing the investigations, and so on. So that would be participation in research.
Okay, so that makes it clearer. So very much listening to this podcast is research engagement because you're hearing from the researchers and anybody who's interested in participation in research and actually contributing and adding their data to a research study. You know, the best place for people with Parkinson's to access that is to go through the Parkinson's Take Part Hub, where you can type in your postcode and that tells you the types of research opportunities that are near you and different types of research. You can engage online or you can actually engage in person. So if that's something you're interested in participation, that would be a good place to go. Okay, so thank you for clearing that up. So a number of acronyms and abbreviations are used in research. So what is the NIHR, the CSO? Who are they and what role and function do they play in research?
Okay, so the NIHR is the National Institute of Health Research. So essentially this is government money. So this is a body that will fund research at a UK level. They have various funding streams available, some of which are available for the whole of the UK, some of which are only available in England and Wales. That's just because of the devolved health in Scotland. But they're a large research funder. The CSO is essentially Scottish government money doing the same job. Being smaller, it tends to fund slightly smaller things, but again, that the purpose of these organisations is to invite applications for research funding, to screen them, and then ultimately to fund them.
And I actually used the term abbreviations there. So the CSO is the Chief Scientist Office, and the NIHR is the National Institute for Health Research. So they are government funding bodies that fund research projects.
That's right.
Perfect. So when we're looking through a lot of studies, I think the ethical approval often comes up. And so that is important for in terms of research integrity and making sure that the participants who take part, their interests are protected. But we understand from researchers this is not a straightforward process to go through. So can you maybe just talk us through what is entailed for researchers to get ethical approval?
So the purpose of ethical approval is several fold. The main one is to ensure that nothing untoward is happening in the research. Now, I should point out that researchers are not trying to do anything that's unethical. But it's really just to make sure that that what they're doing is above board and proper. And there are several principles that need to be adhered to. The first is to respect the autonomy of the participants in the research. So to make sure that the people taking part in the research are well informed in advance about what the research will entail. Because, of course, only if they're well informed about it can they take an informed decision about whether to take part or not. It's important that participants are not coerced into taking part in research. And so you can imagine a situation where a patient may be invited to take part in a research study, but if they're being invited by their consultant, they may feel obliged to take part, or they may be worried that their care would somehow be affected if they chose not to take part. And so one of the jobs of the ethics committee is to make sure that the invitation to take part in research sort of avoids situations like that. It's important that patients know what will happen to them or what they have to do if they take part. It's important that they know that they can withdraw from the research at any time if they wish. And also it's important to know that their data is protected. You know, how is it going to be stored? Who will have access to it? There's a few other aspects. It's important that the research is designed in a way that will try and maximise benefit and reduce harm. And it's also important that ethics committees satisfy themselves that the people taking part in the research are well qualified to do so and have the appropriate training and permissions in order to be able to carry out the research properly.
Okay, so I presume it's the role of the principal investigator to submit to the ethics committee.
Here we get to where terminology is sometimes used differently. So on a small study, a principal investigator might be the person who's ultimately responsible for it. On a larger study, that person might be called the chief investigator. So for example, I run a number of national studies where I am the chief investigator, so the person ultimately responsible for the conduct of the research. But in each of the recruiting sites, and we may be recruiting up from maybe 60 or 80 hospitals across the UK, each of those hospitals will have a principal investigator who is responsible locally for the conduct of that research.
So far we've covered who funds studies and we've talked about the importance of ethics. So if we were then just to move on then to thinking about study design, there's been lots of questions come in about study design. And so we're very familiar with terms such as randomised controlled trial, a blind randomised controlled trial, double blind clinical trial. Can you maybe just expand on what these are for people who perhaps are unfamiliar with those terms?
Yeah, sure. So before that, I'll maybe go back a step. There are two main kinds of study. You can have an observational study and an interventional study. So an observational study is one where the investigators are just observing what is happening to patients. That's not to say the patients aren't asked to do anything. They may be filling in questionnaires. They may be undergoing various physical or clinical examinations. But the key point is that the research process is not interfering with the care they receive. which is why it's called observational study. On an interventional study, then the researcher is intervening in care. So an example of an interventional study would be a randomized controlled trial. So the treatment you receive will depend on some aspect of the study, the study procedure. So crucially, in a randomized controlled trial, patients are randomized to receive one treatment or another treatment. So it may be treatment versus placebo, or it may be a new treatment versus the current existing best treatment for that condition. Blinding is important so that patients and investigators are unaware of what treatment is being delivered. So it's easy to think of this in a drug trial. You can give one group of patients could be randomized to the new drug, a new tablet, and let's say the tablet is small and red and tastes of strawberries. It's important that the people who are randomized to the placebo treatment, that they don't know they're getting placebo, so it's important that the placebo tablets are also small and red and taste of strawberries, so that they can't tell whether they're getting the new drug or whether they're getting the placebo. Double blind just means that not only the patients are unaware of precisely the treatment they're getting, but also the investigators are unaware. Of course, somebody is aware. It tends to be run from a clinical trials unit, and there's maybe a senior statistician who's aware of which group each patient has been randomized to. Of course, blinding becomes more difficult with certain treatments. If you're testing whether a new physiotherapy exercise program is superior to usual care, then clearly the patients are going to know whether they're in the new physio program versus not. So there may be instances where the patients are not blinded to what group they're in. It's important then to ensure that the investigators are blind, or however you're measuring the outcomes of that intervention to see whether it worked. The person doing that measuring is blind to the treatment group.
So why is randomized control trials, perceived as superior to other forms of study design?
So the key issue is the fact that you can introduce, if you don't randomize patients, you can introduce bias or introduce error to the study. And this may be done wittingly, or it may be done unwittingly. It may be, for example, if you weren't randomizing people to treatments and you were just choosing people to go into treatments, it may be that just by accident you happen to have more men in the group who were getting treatment A and more women in the group who were getting treatment B. And then if you want to, if you show that treatment A was superior, you'll be unable to tell that, well, actually, is it due to the treatment, or is it that just actually for this particular condition, men do a little bit better than women? So by randomizing people, you ensure that the two groups are equal. Theoretically, the two groups are equal with respect to all characteristics other than the treatment that they're receiving.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So randomized control trials probably sit there right at the top of the hierarchy if we're thinking about quality of interventional studies. But there's other types of studies called cohort studies and case control studies. Can you tell us what they are and maybe what the pros and cons are of those?
So cohort studies and case control studies are two different kinds of observational study design. So these are studies where the study protocol is not dictating which treatment somebody may receive. I'll start with case control studies first. So case control studies, the key design feature is that you select people to take part in the study because they either have the disease that you're studying or that they don't. In other words, they're either a case or they're not. And what you then do is you look retrospectively to see whether they differ in any way. So you may take people the example I always use when I'm teaching is cigarette smoking and lung cancer. So in a case control study, you would have people with lung cancer are your cases, your people without lung cancer are your controls, And then you look back and say, and look at people's smoking history over the last, whatever, 10, 20 years or so, to determine whether the cancer group, in other words, the cases, whether they have had more cigarette smoking than the control group. A cohort study is essentially the opposite of that. So you select people to take part in the study because they are either exposed to something or not. So they have using the same example, it may be that you take a group of cigarette smokers and you take a group of non-smokers, and then you follow them forward and look to see whether the smokers develop more lung cancer than the non-smokers. So it's really just looking at the same question from two different directions. And there's pros and cons of both. If you're studying a particularly rare disease, then a cohort study can be very inefficient because you have to have huge numbers of participants in order just to get enough of them to have the outcome of interest at the end of the study. So if you've got a particularly rare disease, then a case control study is possibly better because you can go out and identify all the cases that exist, all the people with the disease that exist, and then choose an appropriate control group. Cohort studies tend to be time consuming, and therefore they're more costly. And of course, you have to wait long enough for the disease of interest to develop. So you really have to pick your study design based on a number of characteristics that what you already know about the biology of the disease.
Okay, well, we're going to come back to sample size later because that's another question that people have posed to us. But just while we're on study design then, crossover studies are often something that's also discussed. Can you tell us what they are and why that might be beneficial with people with long-term conditions?
Okay, so there's different kinds of crossover studies. I presume you mean crossover trials. So a crossover trial would be when patients are randomized not to receive, let's say, drug A versus drug B in a study, but they're randomized to the order that they receive them. So one group might receive drug A, the other group might get drug B, and they stay on those drugs for, I don't know, let's say 3 months. There may then be a 1 month washout period, and then the group who received drug A then go on to drug B, the group who received drug B first then go on to drug A. So it's an efficient way of conducting a study because you've got everybody in the study receiving both treatments, but there have to be certain conditions. Obviously, the effect of the drug needs to be relatively short lasting, so there can be a washout period because obviously you don't want to go onto your second drug still having some benefit from the first one, because we won't then be able to determine precisely which drug was having the most benefit. So for some conditions and for some treatments, such as drug trials, then it may be a nice efficient way of doing it. For other treatments where you're testing whether a new surgical implant or a new way of operating in surgery, it's completely inappropriate because clearly you can't then wash out and undo that and have the alternative.
Okay, so the final type of kind of approach to research we want to talk about is a multi-arm, multi-stage study, or a MAMS trial. So we had Carl Counsell on the pod in January, and I know he's involved in a MAMS study with Professor Camille Carroll. Can you tell us what that type of study is and why that might be an advantageous approach?
So this just takes crossover trials to the next level, really, when there may be several different treatment options available and patients will be randomized to more than one of these in various different orders. So you can have, if there are three or four, I mean, there's no limit theoretically of treatments available, patients will be randomized to one. They'll stay on that treatment for a while. They'll then have their outcome measured, whatever the outcome is. Let's say it's an improvement in quality of life. There may then be a washout period. They'll go on to another treatment for the same length of time, measure the outcome. They'll then be randomized to a third one, and so on. So it's an efficient way, especially when there's a limited patient population, of studying the effect of several treatments at one time. And I don't mean several treatments, one patient receiving several treatments at the same time that a patient receiving physio and a new drug and so on. I mean, testing several treatments in the one study.
Okay, so let's go back to talking about sample size. And we often hear that a larger sample is better. Is a large number of research participants necessarily better than a small one? And what sort of things influence researchers when they're designing their studies? What influences their decisions on the number of participants that they need to include?
Right, so, well, I'm an epidemiologist, so yes, I like studies with big numbers. Some of the work that we've done in my group looking at UK Biobank study, for example, we've got study with 500,000 participants. The benefit of big numbers is that it is possible to look at things that are very rare, because, you know, if you've got something that only appears, you know, in 1 in 1,000 people, well, even if you study 2,000 people, you're only going to get 2 people whatever that is. So big numbers allows you to study rarer diseases or rarer outcomes. But the main thing is it allows you to estimate whatever it is you're looking at with a greater degree of precision. When deciding how big a study needs to be, you need to have some idea of what it is you're looking at, and how big an effect you expect to see, and then you've got to decide, well, what's the range of acceptability around that estimate. So to give you an example, so if you were, let's say, doing a cohort study, and you thought that you were studying one group of people who'd received a new package of care, and you thought that 70% of those people would get better with that package of care. Let's say drug A, you think 70% of people would get better with drug A, compared to drug B, when you expected only 50% of people to get better. There's a number of other statistical aspects to the sample size calculation that I won't go into, but broadly speaking, you would expect you would need group A and group B both to be about 120 people. So you'd need your total study would need to be about 240 people. And that's if one group 70% getting better, one group 50% getting better. Whereas if you only thought that 60% of group A we're going to get better. So what you're trying to detect there is a smaller difference. You think there's only a 10% difference between groups rather than a 20. You would need 500 people per group. So in your total study size of being over 1,000 compared to about 240. So how big the difference is between groups is an important determinant of how big the study is going to be. If you want to estimate something that's very small, you're going to need a lot of people. If you think what you're estimating is going to be very big, then you can get away with a smaller amount of people.
Okay, right. So then maybe just add that into the mix when we think about the types of clinical trials. You get stage one trials, stage two trials, stage three trials. Can you just talk us a little bit through about what those stage trials are and how they differ, and perhaps maybe how that influences sample size at each of those stages?
So in clinical trials, a lot of these trials, the early stages are done by, in drug trials, are done by pharmaceutical companies. So a stage one or a phase one trial is really just, tends to be healthy volunteers, a very small number of people, just trying to understand some of the basic biology about these drugs, checking things for safety. There's no, you don't want to get any strange safety signals and things like that. These are often called the sort of the first in man studies. The phase two studies are trying to get basic estimates of how the size of effect. Is this drug working like we think it's working in a patient population? Just to try and say, well, actually, what I just said a minute ago, that, you know, we were talking about 70% of people getting better or 60% of people, you know, where do those estimates come from? They'll come from a phase two trial. They tend to be very, very small. Maybe the drug's given to I don't know, the numbers will vary, 20, 30, 40 patients, just to see how many improve. Again, checking for there's no unusual safety signals. The phase three trials are often called the definitive trials. These are the ones that companies need for need to demonstrate success when they're trying to get their marketing authorization, so the drug gets a license. These tend to be much bigger, powered to detect a statistically significant difference between between two groups, they tend to be hundreds of people rather than tens of people.
Okay, and if people want to hear more about the sort of drug trials, one of our earlier podcasts by Alan Main really focused on some of the trials and tribulations about getting drug trials moved from stage one to stage two, so that might be a good pod to listen to. Okay, I'm going to move a little bit of a gear change. People have said that there can be a number of things that affect reliability in research. What are the types of research errors that can perhaps impact the reliability of research findings? What are the key things?
So reliability can mean several things. So it's one of those words that epidemiologists use, and we mean it to be something really quite specific. So when I say reliability, I mean the ability of something to be measured repeatedly. So if you measure it in different contexts, do you get the same result? If different people do the measure, do you get the same result? When we're talking about studies, however, it's the same context. When we say if a study is reliable, what we mean is that do we think these results are reproducible? And of course, that's an important part of science, that that if someone has published a study, and you know the method should be very clear, somebody else should be able to replicate that in a different environment to demonstrate that those results were reliable, those results were repeatable, and therefore it increases trust in the original study findings, because with all the best will in the world, people spend millions of pounds conducting studies, but of course you can get results that arise by chance. If you do a study and you show that a new drug is twice as good as a previous drug, I'd want to see a second study confirming that. Is it twice as good? Perhaps it's not quite that good. Of course, perhaps it might be better. So really, the reliability in that context is an indication of how much we can trust the study results. Are they reproducible? Are they replicatable? And the things that affect that, there can be many things. I mean, different studies are controlled, are conducted differently. But even if you try and do exactly the same thing, obviously the second study will have slightly different patients. The patients in the second study might be a little bit older. There might be a higher proportion of men in the second study than there was in women. The people in the second study might have slightly worse disease. They might have fewer comorbidities. So there may be many differences between the study populations. But if the studies come up with the same result, then this adds a lot of confidence into interpreting the findings of the first study.
Okay, so another term that people have asked about is the term peer-reviewed. What does this mean, and how important is it if they're reading something that says it's peer-reviewed?
So peer review is the process where essentially scientists judge the mark the homework of other scientists. So this is an important step in research and happens at several stages. So first of all, anyone who wants to do research will have to get that research funded. I'm not talking about industry now. They have their own money and can fund what they want. But for all university researchers who want to do, or health service researchers who want to do research, they have to get that funded. Typically, that involves submitting a grant application to somebody like the NIHR or the CSO or a research funding charity. As part of that body's decision-making process, that grant application will be sent out to a number of experts in the field, and they'll be asked to comment on how how good the science looks. So the peer review, it'll go to clinical experts, it will go to research experts, it might go to statisticians. If it's qualitative research, it will go to qualitative experts. And they will be asked for their opinion on the quality of the study design. Does this protocol look like it will achieve what it is trying to achieve? But also, are they trying to answer the right question? And this is where patient involvement comes in. So you can say, well, actually, this is a question that is of real importance to patients, because we've spoken to patients and they've told us that. So that's one level of peer review before you even get the money, before you even start. The second time it happens is when you try and publish your research. So you've done your study, it's taken you several years, you write up your results, you send it off to a scientific journal, and the journal then sends it off to experts in the field for peer review. So they will then give another assessment of how well the study was done. Do they think anything's missing? If it's not been written up as clearly as it could have been, they might ask for clarification. They might ask, you've said you've got data on A, B, and C. Did you have data on D as well? That would help improve this paper. At that point, it's often a bit of a to and fro between the journal and the researcher. Some of the questions you can answer. Sometimes you say, well, we agree it would have been nice to have information on D, but unfortunately we didn't collect it. But that peer review is essentially trying to do the same job as the original peer review, which is trying to make sure that paper can be as high a quality and of most benefit as it can be.
All right, well, that leads lovely onto my last question. So people with Parkinson's all have their hopes on a new wonder drug or even a cure pinned on research. And I think the Parkinson's community, you know, they see many bold headlines about potential new drugs that are coming online. But can you give us some thoughts about how can you tell with the reliability of that research study when you're reading it? What should they be looking out for when they're reading through something that makes some bold claims?
That's difficult. It depends what the claims are. And obviously the people who write up, scientists who write up studies, they want people to read them. If there are bold claims to make, they want to make them, because if they, you know, everyone thinks their results are important. So I think really what to look for is, you know, has the project been well explained? Can you follow what's been done? Is it absolutely clear where their bold claim comes from? There are examples in the scientific literature where if you look at the headline of the press release from that's come from the university, they'll say something really bold and sensational. But of course, the purpose of the press release is to get the media to try and pick that up and think, oh, the university's done something very exciting. Is that nice, attractive, sexy, bold headline? Is that really justified by the results of the study, or is it a little bit of sort of artistic license? So what I read is I go through the methods in detail. Can I follow what the researchers have done? Is it immediately clear what they've done? If they say they've measured 10 things, have they then presented results from 10 things, or have they only presented results from perhaps 8 things? And then it leads to the question, well, what about the results from the other two? Perhaps the results from the other two, you know, are showing something opposite or not showing the same thing to the same extent. These are the sort of things that I would hope that peer review would identify and pick up. But it's really the for judging a bold claim is can you decide that the paper that is making the claim, is it really clear from the methods and the results that claim is justified? And also the discussion part of a scientific paper, really that's where the authors of the paper, the scientists who've done the work, can interpret their results, put the results into other contexts. So, you know, what are they saying about it? Are they saying that their results concur with previous literature? Have other people studied the same thing in slightly different ways? And, you know, are these new results, are they taking it further? Are they contradicting previous work? So it's really just trying to put it all into context. But it is difficult. If someone's making a bold claim, it's sometimes you've really got to go into it, and it's sometimes quite a complex judgment to decide whether you think the claim is valid.
Yeah, and I suppose it comes back to the type of study it is, the number of people that they recruited, because it could be an exciting study, but it was based on maybe 5 or 6 people. So it maybe shows promise, but at the moment, it's not something that necessarily would change practice when they're based on such a small sample.
I think that's exactly right. And if, you know, someone's making really bold claims on 5 or 6 people, I think the claim has to be, you know, this looks really exciting. The next stage is X, you know, where X is a bigger study, a multi-center study, you know, anything that's making a bold claim also has to fully describe the limitations of a study. One of the most important sections of a research paper, I think, is where the authors acknowledge the limitations of what was done. And that can be from, we were trying to recruit 300 patients, 150 for group A, 150 for group B, but actually, because of various reasons, we only managed to recruit 120 in each group. Then turned out that actually 20 from each group dropped out. So where we hoped to have our analysis based on 150 people per group, we've actually only been able to do this study based on 100 per group. So what does that do? Well, that means that you don't have as much confidence in the results, because the sample size that you were hoping for is less. You can't estimate things with such, you know, with the same degree of precision. But as long as the authors have taken account of that, and indeed many other methodological aspects, that's really how you make that judgment. But you're right, something based on 5 or 6 can only be promising. It can't be definitive.
Wow. I can't believe we filled all that time. Thank you very much for that today, Gareth. That has been fantastic. And I think just to add to that, people who are interested in research findings, it might be useful if you aren't already to join the Research Support Network, which is organised by Parkinson's UK. And then from that, you can get sent their Progress magazine, which summarises some of the key research findings, which have been reviewed, not only peer-reviewed but within the journals that we've talked about on this podcast, but have also been, you know, reviewed by Parkinson's UK. And that can keep you up to date with sort of current research findings, which can be useful. A huge thank you very much for today. It's been a really informative session.
Thank you.